Welcome to World Policy on Air, a weekly podcast from the pages and website of World Policy Journal, published by the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. I'm David Alpern. In this week's program, posted November 17, 2017, we spotlight a recent World Policy blog post on the controversial reconciliation and forgiveness legislation that threatens still fragile democracy in Tunisia, birthplace of the so-called Arab Spring. We'll also spotlight top stories in the WPJ fall issue, cover line Constructing Family. But first, some timely insights from global affairs analyst and author Michael Moran, head of transformative.io, risk and geostrategy consultants, and a visiting fellow at the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
Thanks, David. Nearly 7 years have passed, the anniversary is December 10, since the death of a young Tunisian named Mohamed Bouazizi, who lit himself on fire to protest the corruption and repression of his North African country. Bouazizi died soon afterwards, but the regime of Tunisia's dictator, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, died with him, taken down about a month later by what came to be known as the Jasmine Revolution. More amazing still was the fact that Tunisia's revolution spread, ultimately toppling dictators in Libya and Egypt, bringing people into the streets of Bahrain, Jordan, and Yemen, and touching off civil war that rages to this day in Syria. Given what we know now, was all this a good thing? Tens of thousands are dead, most of them innocent civilians, and for the most part the Arab Middle East is still in the grip of repressive single-party regimes of various stripes, ranging from puritanical to murderous to merely repressive. Optimists hold out hope for gradual reforms in places like Jordan or Morocco, or for an evolution toward more liberty that might go along with the wealth created in the Gulf Emirates. But generally speaking, it's a pretty miserable legacy. So what of Tunisia? Since 2010, it's been held up as the great exception to all the failed efforts at democratic form that touched off the Arab Spring. But can its revolution really be considered a success? Last week, for instance, Tunisia's government yet again extended a state of emergency, which curbs individual rights in the name of anti-terrorist measures. It's been in place since a spate of such attacks in 2015. And a lot, indeed, has gone wrong. Having initially elected a pro-democracy dissident to lead them, the country is now led by a technocrat, Youssef Chahid, who has launched an impressive anti-corruption campaign. But democracy has been challenged from the start, buffeted by the violence and chaos in neighboring Libya, and a porous Saharan border that is an easy mark for weapons smugglers and terrorists. The attacks on resorts popular with European tourists damaged a key sector of Tunisia's economy. And this year, the U.S. makes it worse by cutting desperately needed aid to the country by nearly 70%, from $167 million to $54 million in 2018. But even with all this, Tunisia's revolution has survived. A poll conducted in April by an American NGO found that most Tunisians still believe that democracy is preferable to all other forms of government. Two-thirds of the population also do not consider that Tunisia is yet a full democracy. That sounds about right. The movement set in motion by a young man's suicide in 2010 has set down some shallow roots at home, even if it failed to take abroad. But in the face of aid cuts and continued chaos next door in Libya, and a tourist economy stunted by terrorism, there is still cause for concern. Without more help from established democracies, Tunisia's incredibly important experiment could falter, proving as ephemeral as the jasmine blossoms that skitter across the streets of Bizerte, Tunis, and Djerba. For World Policy on Air, I'm Michael Moran.
You're listening to World Policy on Air. Now this.
That the gains of the revolution are at stake right now. Instead of establishing the truth, people in power are doing everything to hide the truth, and it's so sad for Tunisia. It is so
the sound of street demonstrations in Tunisia 6 years ago that led to the so-called Jasmine Revolution against entrenched dictatorship in that country, followed by the wider, if largely temporary, democratic Arab Spring. Then Tunisian activist and blogger Lina Benmeni, last month on a new law ostensibly meant to promote national reconciliation by giving amnesty in many cases of Tunisia's notorious pre-revolution corruption. Instead, the legislation has sparked stormy debates in parliament and a new round of protests in the streets. That controversy in practically the only Arab country where Arab Spring democracy successfully took root is examined in a recent World Policy blog post by Amna Gwilali, Tunisia director for Human Rights Watch. The headline is New Reconciliation Law Threatens Tunisia's Democracy, and we talked about it the other day for this podcast. Amna Gwilali, welcome to World Policy on Air.
Hello, thank you for hosting me.
The Jasmine Revolution began with the self-immolation of a street vendor who felt mistreated by the local government, but it was fueled by widespread anger over many national policies, economic conditions, and corruption under a 20-year dictatorship. Talk about the 2012 Commission report detailing just how extensive that corruption was.
The 2012 report from a commission which was put in place after the uprising in order to examine the extent of corruption in Tunisia has found that there was widespread corruption which was instituted at the highest levels of the state authorities. There was corruption which was rampant throughout the system, and many of the ministers and people acquainted with the Ben Ali family were very much involved in this widespread corruption. The commission's report unraveled the ways in which corruption worked, how very high-level officials inside the state have facilitated the corruption, how they have given to the different cronies of the regime, all the advantages in order to have very much gains which were illegal, how they helped them to get hold of some of the wealth of the Tunisian, state.
Remind us of the reforms and the wide range of new rights that Tunisia enacted after the revolution.
Indeed, after the revolution, which, as you put it, was prompted by very deeply rooted frustrations and grievances and demands for justice, for human rights, for economic equality, etc. There were, after the revolution in 2011, several steps that were undertaken by the successive Tunisian government in order to respond to these demands, at least very partially. There were, for example, the adoption in 2014 of a new constitution, which was hailed internationally as being very progressive, as upholding many of the international human rights principles, and offering to the Tunisian people and to the Tunisian citizens their rights and their right to freedom, their right to justice, and to participate in the public debate. So freedom of speech and everything else. There was also there were several free and transparent elections, especially the elections that took place in 2014 for electing the new legislative assembly and electing a new president. Also, these elections are considered as a step forward for the consolidation of democracy. However, despite all this progress, there were also several setbacks in this democratic transition, especially given this new law that we are talking about administrative reconciliation.
Well, tell us, when and how did the new president first propose and explain this new reconciliation law as necessary to, quote, improve the investment climate, unquote?
The president of the Republic, Beji Caid Sibti, proposed this new law in March 2015. It was during the celebration of the Independence Day, and the president at that time said that he is proposing this law in order to help the Tunisian people break with, heal the wounds of the past. He is proposing it in order to give a new impetus to the economy and to help the investors gain new confidence in the Tunisian economic in the Tunisian economy. The declaration from the president at that time sparked a lot of controversy, especially that the president had already made many, many other declarations very much against the transitional justice process, against prosecuting those who have been involved in human rights violations or corruption from the former regime, and calling for, forgetting all of this and turning the page of the past in order to go to the future and in order to, go ahead with the democracy. So that was his stance at that time, and he moved forward with the law by proposing it to the parliament in December 2015, and then the law was taken over by the parliament.
The law that ultimately passed created two categories of civil servants involved in corruption. What were they, and what was the stated purpose of drawing such a distinction?
So the distinction that was established in the law is between civil servants who allegedly committed acts of corruption without personally benefiting from these acts, and those who embezzled public funds for their own gain. So the law distinguishes between those who put money in their pockets, so to say, and those who just signed orders or facilitated the act of corruption and embezzlement without putting anything in their own pockets and without benefiting from it. And for the first group, so those who have benefited from corruption personally and financially, they would be excluded from the remit of the law. And those who have just signed a paper to facilitate the corruption or, facilitated corruption in any other way would be amnestied from any prosecution and from and they will be there will be an amnesty, a general amnesty for them in order to clear their judicial record from any prosecution or from any wrongdoing. The problem with this distinction is that it is a total illusion. The law does not set up a clear way or mechanism to identify those who have allegedly profited from corruption. So to identify them, it's not something that is so simple. It's not just by way of declaration from the law. You have to investigate these acts of corruption in order to identify those who have served the system and those who have benefited from the system. But the law is totally silent on such a mechanism and does not separate those who have had ill-gotten gains from those who have simply executed orders. In addition to that, it does not cover indirect gains such as promotions or benefits for a person's family. So as a result of that, it is really very difficult that the law will be an effective tool against those who have benefited from corruption or who have been accomplices to misappropriation. So this distinction at the end of the day is an illusion, and the law will be a blanket amnesty for everyone, including those who have gained something personally from corruption.
In fact, you say the new law could turn perpetrators into victims and actually reward them.
That's the turning perpetrators into victims in the law is the most ironic aspect of this law, because what the law does is not only that it will amnesty those who have been involved in corruption at the highest levels in the administration, but it also requires the state to repay them the damages or to give them back the money that they had to give back to the state when they were prosecuted or when they were tried, because there were several trials after the revolution, and several civil servants were had to pay some damages to the state as a result of their of these judicial trials. Now, what they had paid to the state because they were involved in corruption, etc., the state has to pay it back to them. So they become victims at the end. Those who have been involved in corruption and found guilty by the judiciary are now compensated back by the state. And this is something that is quite ironic and very grotesque at the end of the day, because it gives the corrupt civil servants in the administration a status of victim, which is really something problematic.
On a broader scale, you see the new law adversely impacting the work of Tunisia's Truth and Dignity Commission. Explain the commission's mandate and how it may be undermined.
The Truth and Dignity Commission was established in late 2013. It started working in 2014. This commission was entrusted by the law to examine and investigate past human rights violations, including economic violations that were committed on a large scale by the former regime, and to transfer some of the most egregious cases to the judiciary. The commission has also the mandate to investigate and determine the perpetrators of acts of corruption and embezzlement of public funds. This commission has really a very important role in the democratic transition. It has to establish the truth of what happened. It has to identify the perpetrators, and it has to transfer cases to the judiciary. And at the end of the day, after all doing all of that, it has to propose reforms of the system so that we don't have a relapse into authoritarianism anymore. And so its role is really key, and it has the mandate to examine these corruption cases. However, the law, the administrative reconciliation law, withdrew such power on investigating corruption from the Truth and Dignity Commission and gives another commission, which is not independent and not really very effective, the right to give these kind of amnesties. So this law threatens the entire transitional justice process at the end of the day, because the commission will be weakened by such a law. It will not be able to investigate cases of corruption anymore. It will not be able to identify the perpetrators of these acts of corruption on a wide scale, and this will hamper its ability to establish the truth of what happened and to give to the Tunisian citizens their right to know what happened. So this is all this law will really have will impair the whole transitional justice process.
And how do you see the new law affecting trust in government generally, the absence of which helped spark the revolution 6 years ago?
Yeah, ironically, the law's objective, as stated in its preamble, is to restore confidence in the administration. That's the stated objective of the law. However, it's very clear that what the law will do is totally the opposite. The law will entrench corruption inside the administration. It will give the corrupt civil servants who have been really at the heart of corruption the sense of impunity, and it will give them the sense that they are becoming more powerful in the new system. It will also signal to other civil servants the leniency of the government and the authorities towards corruption, since amnesty was since there is amnesty for corruption. So it will do exactly the opposite of what the law in its preamble says about restoring confidence in the administration.
I see that before the new law was signed by the president at the end of October, it was referred to the nation's temporary constitutional commission. Could that body still rule against it, or is there some other path to rejecting or revising it?
The temporary constitutional commission has already examined the law it was supposed to rule on the constitutionality of this administrative reconciliation law. Unfortunately, the commission was split. This constitutional commission is composed of six members, and they were split three against it and three for the administrative reconciliation law. So this meant that there was no real constitutionality, you know, examination of this law, and it was then transferred by way of law to the President of the Republic, who signed it and promulgated this administrative reconciliation law. Again, another irony of the system. The President of the Republic, who had proposed the law initially and was the very fierce promoter of the law, is the one who is signing it as if it was a constitutional law, and this is something really problematic. So now we don't have recourses against this law anymore, except before the administrative tribunal. That's the only maybe new recourse. Because the law was adopted in a way that was not really respectful of the procedures. So it will be on the basis of procedural breaches that a challenge to this law could be lodged before the administrative tribunal.
Do you see the street protests and other opposition to this law leading to yet another revolution, or at least a change of government leadership in the next election or even before?
The adoption of this law was met with quite fierce protests on the streets in Tunisia. There was a very important opposition movement created against this law, a movement called Manishim Semah, I Will Not Forget or Forgive. And this movement has gained a lot of steam during these months and during these 2 years after the announcement of the law, but unfortunately did not really, it was not, successful in rejecting the law or not allowing it to pass. So despite all the popular protests, the law was passed, and this is, I don't think it is likely that there will be other protests against the law, since now it is already passed, but the movement of protests will continue against the policies of the government, against corruption, etc., and it might lead to not a new revolution, but something changing maybe in the political landscape, especially that we are about to hold municipal elections, so it will be a very important point of contention in the elections.
Amna Galali, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Amna Galali is Tunisia Director for Human Rights Watch. Her recent post on the World Policy blog is New Reconciliation Law Threatens Tunisia's Democracy. Featured in the WPJ Fall issue, you'll find articles about defending families from terrorist recruitment, about the drawbacks to Latin America's responsible paternity laws, and about the Trump effect on gay rights in Liberia. World Policy on Air is a production of World Policy Journal at the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. Interim editor Jessica Laudis, managing editor Laurel Jerombeck, podcast producer Isabel Vasquez. I'm David Alpern.